little ones and the smell of baking from the kitchen. Without a word to his wife, and bold as brass, he writes to old Mahmood and cuts a deal. Mahmood supplies the Dominion Coal and Steel Company, and James will supply Mahmood. With boots only. But that's a significant product where mines and mills are concerned. Mahmood will lend James the startup money and then buy the boots below the wholesale rate he currently pays to ship them from Halifax into his Sydney store. James starts making boots.
Daddy?
Yes, Kathleen?
Are you all right?
I'm right as rain.
It's my birthday today.
Happy birthday, old buddy.
Thank you. Daddy?
Yes?
Would you like me to sing to you?
I'd love that, my dear, but I've work to do.
Mahmood develops a grudging respect for his good-for-nothing son-in-law, but draws the line at direct contact with James or the family.
Fine with James.
They exchange messages via Leo Taylor. James starts to make money. He digs out the business cards he collected at Kathleen's recital in Halifax years ago. Makes inquiries. He writes to the chief administrator of the Metropolitan Opera of New York.
Dear sir, who, in your expert opinion, would you say is the preeminent practitioner in the field of vocal training?
He receives the answer, and sends a lengthy telegram to a man with a German-sounding name in New York City. Receives a reply.
Yes, Herr Blank. We'll see Kathleen in his studio at 64th Street and Central Park West, 10 a.m., March 1st, 1918.
James writes to his spinster cousin, Giles, in New York.
And as my mother always spoke highly of you, naturally I am prepared to reimburse you for any and all.
The time has come. Kathleen is barely 18, but her voice is ready. And cousin Giles has agreed to act as a chaperone. Moreover, James no longer deludes himself as to where the girl is likely to be safest. Even with the boots, it becomes apparent that this step will be crushing to the family finances. James does not hesitate. He writes to Mahmood and asks him straight out for money to send the girl to New York. The directness of the request startles Mahmood even more than James's initial business overture. Ensconced in a mauve satin armchair, his slippered feet resting on a cushioned ottoman, Mahmood squints and reads the note a second time. Surrounded, as he is, by comfortable curves, it is easy to see how angular Mahmood has become with the years. Business has eroded flesh and sharpened bones. Vigilance has contracted the eyes, which are as keen as ever. His hair has thinned to a meticulous steel gray, and two deep lines crease either side of his leather face from cheekbones to jaw. He has grown to resemble his spare wooden chair in the back room of his shop. Only Mrs. Mahmood looks at him now and sees the tall, dark, and handsome he used to be. Mahmood glances up from James's letter over to the old accursed piano. The voice comes from the Mahmood side, of course.
All the men and women of his family sing, born singing. It is a gift from God, and apparently God and Mr. Mahmood have transmitted this gift through materia. Dead to me. She is dead.
To the eldest daughter of the Anclise bastard.
Too bad. She is no granddaughter of mine.
Mahmood raises the forefinger of his left hand slightly, and his wife replenishes his teacup. In the kitchen, Teresa Taylor chops parsley for tabbouleh, and wonders why Mr. Mahmood treats his wife like a maid now that he can afford several real ones. The old standby about the strangeness of white people doesn't really apply here, because although you'd take your life in your hands if you said it, the Mahmoods aren't really white, are they? They're something else. They are somewhat colored. What this means in Nova Scotia at this time is that, for the Mahmoods, the color bar that guards access to most aspects of society tends to be negotiable. It helps that they have money. Teresa is a beauty. Although most people in these parts might not think so unless they saw a picture of her in a book about Africa. Everything about Teresa is tall. Her face, her eyes especially. Everything about her is fine. Her hands dicing tomatoes, her ankles standing, striding between counter, table, and sink 9 hours a day. Her voice with its trace of Barbados. And beneath her dress, the silver cross she wears that Hector gave her. Teresa won't be a maid forever. She is engaged to be married. She squeezes the juice of 3 lemons and says a little prayer of thanks to Jesus for keeping Hector safe. In 1914, he volunteered to go overseas and fight, but the army wouldn't have him. This was a white man's war. They didn't want a checkerboard army. Hector went into the steel plant instead and swore off wars altogether. Now they can't conscript him because he is in a vital industry. Teresa and Hector are both saving money so that he can go to the United States and study to become an Anglican minister. Teresa has known Hector all her life. When she was 10, their families came here at the same time, moving from a lush island to a stark one, so their daddies could work, first in the mines, then at the mill. Teresa has grown up in the coke ovens section of Sydney's Whitney Pier, and despite the ongoing battle with grime from the trains and smokestacks, she wouldn't want to live anywhere else, except New York City. That's where she and Hector will move once they're married. Thus, Teresa does not begrudge a single working hour at the Mahmoods. And it really isn't a bad job. She likes the food she's learned to prepare for them, this tabbouleh, for instance. It makes a nice change from the Anglos and Scotch she has worked for, with their endless meat and potatoes and not a spice in sight. Most of the Mahmoods are very friendly, and they know how to throw a party, always singing, with no need of liquor to let go, not like the meat and potatoes set. And Mr. Mahmood pays well. Teresa has already started buying her trousseau. He expects the best, but unlike most, he's prepared to pay for it. He hasn't forgotten where he came from. Nor has he ever made an improper advance, though he does have a temper. Ask his daughters. In the meantime, Teresa works hard, stays out of his way, and feels sorry for her. Mrs. Mahmood has everything money can buy, not to mention a devoted family and lots of grandchildren. But she has a private sorrow, too, Teresa can tell. Teresa drains the water from the cracked weed the Lebanese call burgle and folds it into the spiced meat. They're having kibba tonight. In the big front room, Mr. Mahmood dozes while his wife, Giselle, looks on. Except for her gray bun, she seems not to have changed at all over the years. The same smooth round face, round arms, soft eyes. She is wearing her moonstone ring and strand of genuine pearls to please her husband. Carefully, she removes the note from his hand and takes it into the kitchen. Teresa, read, please. Mrs. Mahmood has never learned to read English. Teresa reads the letter aloud, then says, Kathleen Piper, that's the young lady we heard sing at the Lyceum before the war. Mrs. Mahmood nods, my granddaughter. Teresa raises an eyebrow. The girl my little brother ferries to and from school. The princess who has never spoken a single word to him. The one with the voice. Well. That's your granddaughter, Mrs. Mahmood. Giselle nods. That night in bed, Giselle skillfully enlightens her husband as to his own intentions. In the morning, he writes a check. He tells himself that he does it for Giselle. But as he writes the third zero, he reflects upon the future of the family voice. Universally acclaimed, the crowning glory of his success in the new world. Only Teresa will do for an errand of such importance, and Mahmoud puts the envelope into her hand, saying, "Get a receipt." Teresa sets out for New Waterford, where she anticipates a rare look at the severed branch of the Mahmoud family tree. Materia answers the door. She is wearing a smock. She has a pair of stained scissors in her hand. She's been cutting kidneys for a pie. Little Frances stands peeking out from behind the foliage of her mother's crazy floral print. Materia's gaze has widened over the years, as though she sees more of the world at once than other people do. But although she seems to see more, she does not have the expression of someone who is processing what she sees. She doesn't look, she stares. Now she's staring up at Teresa. Teresa recognizes the look of someone who's not all there. Teresa would have assumed that the big, sad woman in the doorway was the hired help, had she not been prepared to spot the Mahmoud family resemblance, discernible in the shade and smoothness of the skin, in Mrs. Mahmoud's eyes veiled in a vague face.
"Mrs. Piper?"
Materia nods. Teresa inquires politely, "Is Mr. Piper home, ma'am?" Wee Frances has never seen a black person before. Everyone around her is chalk white except for her own tan mother. She reaches out to Teresa and touches one of her hands, the one holding the envelope. Teresa smiles down at her. Frances collects the moment and puts it in a safe place with two or three others. Meanwhile, Materia has muttered something and waved her scissors in the general direction of the shed at the side of the house. Teresa heads for the shed, and Frances follows her. Materia returns to her kidneys. Snip, snap. Through the crack in the door, Frances sees Teresa hand an envelope to Daddy. Daddy opens the envelope and looks at the contents for quite a while. Then Teresa gets him to write something on a piece of paper that she puts back into her purse. When Teresa comes out of the shed, Frances is lingering nearby.
"What do you want, darling? Where did you get all that pretty yellow hair?"
Frances gazes up by way of an answer. What she wants is everything about this fabulous woman, who is surely a queen from some far-off place. Teresa would laugh if she knew. "The Queen of Whitney Pier, dear."
"Here you go, honey."
Teresa hands Frances a piece of rock candy just as... "Frances!" The child and the woman look up to see the golden girl step from the taxi cab that is pulled up in front of the house. Leo Taylor has an actual automobile now, a Model T Ford with his name stenciled on the side, Leo Taylor Transport. He holds the door open, and Kathleen walks past him without a glance. It was she who called out and interrupted the sweet transaction. Now she walks stately toward them, and in cultivated tones, inquires of Teresa, "Can I help you, miss?"
"To heck with you," thinks Teresa. "No, Miss Piper, I just dropped something off for your father." "Hey, Therese, come on, girl."
Leo Taylor doesn't like to linger here. Teresa shakes her head as she climbs into her brother's cab. The Pipers, living like hillbillies, acting like royalty. They drive away.
"Show me your hand, Frances."
Frances opens her little hand and reveals the black and white licorice peppermint. A prize. Kathleen takes the sweet and throws it in a high arc across the yard, till it lands in the creek with a small plop.
"You know you shouldn't take candy from strangers, Francis, especially colored strangers."
Lady Liberty. Girl as she was, Claudia looked upon the world before her like some young untried knight. Claudia by A.L.O.E. Kathleen is truly and utterly and completely Kathleen in New York. That's what the city does for you, if it's meant for you. She's got plenty of personality and no history, and she has never breathed so much air in her life. She comes from an Atlantic island surrounded by nothing but sea air. Yet in the man-made outdoor corridors of this fantastic city, she can finally breathe. This air is what the gods live upon, the gods who get things done, not the gods who mope on ancient promontories and exhale fossil vapors, waiting for someone to fill in the fragments of forgotten sagas that have come unraveled with age. Those gods have sagged so long on their rocks, they are well on the way to turning to stone themselves. But the new gods, that bright baritone chorus, they inhabit every steel support, every suspension bridge, every gleaming silver train, all things vertical and horizontal, all glass, gravel, and sand. They take big breaths, and they make big sounds, and with every breath and sound, they open up more sky. When Kathleen steps onto Pier 54, she starts writing the book of her life in her head. And then she arrived in the new world. She heard the heels of her sensible shoes ring out on the gangplank and resolved never to be sensible. There are a bewildering number of uniformed porters and ununiformed scamps ready to seize her trunk and make off with it. But Kathleen hauls it to the center of the terminal and sits on it beneath the big clock, an eye out for her distant cousin, not minding the wait, serenaded by the crowds. It's clear. The whole world comes to New York City. Kathleen intends to be the Eleonora Duse of the operatic stage. If anyone can do this, she can. A classically trained girl with modern ideas about holding the mirror up to nature. The born performer's zeal to leave no heart intact. An engine in her stroked so high it turned her hair red in the womb. Her mixed Celtic-Arab blood and her origins on the scraggly island off the east coast of a country popularly supposed to consist of a polar ice cap are enough, by American standards, both to cloak her in sufficient diva mystery and to temper the exotic with a dash of windswept North American charm. She'll refer to pickled moose meat and kippered cod tongues and occasionally swear in Arabic just to get the legend rolling. But she is of the New World, the Golden West. She is no Sicilian or Castilian castaway bound for glory, then early ruin. Like them, she is going to be great. But unlike them, she is going to survive. She has decided never to stop singing. She will be singing at 75. She eats a frankfurter in a bun she bought from a fat man with a black mustache, who told her the story of his life in broken English. Her life has finally started. Kathleen? Kathleen turns and sees a little spinster lady. I'm Giles. Welcome to New York City, dear. Giles, to whom Kathleen has been entrusted, has unfaded blue eyes and a genteel apartment in Greenwich Village. Kathleen estimates Giles's age to be in the vicinity of 102. In fact, Giles is a young 60. Perhaps, Kathleen speculates, Giles was once a schoolteacher. Or, better, perhaps, Giles is a beneficiary of that vague yet respectable means of support known among English literary heroines as an annuity. Being retired, Giles volunteers at a convent infirmary, where she helps old nuns to die. Her highest qualification for this calling is not her compassion, or her surprisingly strong stomach, or even her piety. It is her unshockability. Giles has lowered her ear to many a withered mouth and heard confessions no priest ever has, for toward the end there is often confusion, a sudden disquiet, lest one has, after all, confessed and repented of the wrong things in life. Ancient sins bloom afresh, fragrant with the purity they possessed a moment before they were named and nipped in the bud. And having listened, Giles may remark, "I know, dear." Sometimes the dying words come in the form of a question to which Giles may reply upon reflection, "I wonder that myself, dear, from time to time. Truly I do." But Giles never asks any questions herself, all of which makes Giles a pretty poor chaperone for a young champion like Kathleen. That first night in Giles's guest room, which overlooks the roofs of the village and affords a view of the tallest buildings on earth, Kathleen opens a fresh new Holy Angel's notebook and writes on the virgin page, 8 p.m., February 29th, 1918, New York City. Dear Diary. She keeps her appointment the next day at the corner of 64th Street and Central Park West in a fifth-floor studio. It is a room of excellent posture. There is a Frenchified sofa that is apparently not for sitting. To the right of the door stands a bust of Verdi atop a marble column. To the left is Mozart. On the gleaming parquet floor, a Persian carpet. A high coffered ceiling in mahogany. A giant window onto the park. A grand piano. An immaculate wheat-colored man with a goatee, morning coat, tapered trousers, and striped cravat. The maestro. From somewhere in Europe. Brief introductions. She is not invited to be seated. She is instructed to sing something. She does. It's a small room. It's a big voice. The maestro's gaze alights on a corner of the carpet, disinterested as an insect, and stays there for the duration of the song. Kathleen finishes. The maestro glances up and perceives the flush on her face, the moist glistening of her eye, the pulse at her neck, her lips still parted, and he says in a wafer-thin voice, "We have a lot of work to do." Corruption hangs in the air around a great talent. Such a gift is unstable by nature, apt to embarrass its handlers. About her there is the whiff of the entertainer, like vaudeville nipping the heels of grand opera. The maestro smells all this on Kathleen and cools his blood to a temperature undetectable by wild animals. Before him lies a grueling task. It is so much easier to shape competence. Yet, in a small spot beneath the hardest part of his skull, the maestro is feverish with excitement. You don't get a student like this every day, perhaps two in a lifetime. He prepares to show her no mercy. As Kathleen works harder and harder, she walks farther and farther, between sadistic singing lessons with the maestro and suffocatingly sedate suppers with Giles, Kathleen walks the length and breadth of the island of Manhattan, from the East River to the Hudson, from Battery Park to the Harlem River. One day, a girl is sitting at the maestro's grand piano when Kathleen drags herself up to the studio. She is Rose, in a pale pink dress perfect for a dear little thing with an open face and a trusting nature, and therefore all wrong on Rose. Rose is an extremely good pianist. But Kathleen doesn't notice that at first, for two reasons. First, Because when you're training with a famous bastard in New York City, with one eye on the mat and the other on obscurity, you don't notice the quality of the piano accompaniment during your lesson unless it is incompetent. But this pianist is doubly inaudible because she is black, and therefore outside any system that nurtures and advances a classical virtuosa. So Kathleen thinks of Rose not as a pianist, but as an accompanist. When Rose looks at Kathleen the first time, she sees a daughter of fortune and looks back down at her piano keys. When she looks the second time, it is to verify that the sound that just filled the room really came from that milk-fed thing standing on the carpet. The voice is worth considering. The singer can go to hell. "The piano is out of tune," says Kathleen. Ordinarily, Kathleen says nothing during her lessons. She makes the sounds the maestro orders her to make, and in the privacy of her own mind, thinks up a thousand devastating retorts with which to slay him. But today she is impelled to speak. Because what's the good of an accompanist if she can't hear when the piano is off key? Kathleen has addressed her observation to the maestro, but Rose addresses Kathleen. "The piano is perfectly in tune. You're flat." Kathleen glares at the accompanist, with equal parts fury and disbelief. And the accompanist looks back, calm, level gaze. Insolent, more like it. How dare she? Handsome features cut like sculpture into her face, so at odds with the puffed sleeves and schoolgirl braids. Kathleen looks away dismissively from the beanpole in a hand-me-down dress. She expects the maestro to scold the accompanist, or, preferably, fire her. But instead, he turns to Kathleen. "Perhaps if you were less intent upon making noise, and more intent upon listening, you might learn to hear the difference between that," the maestro jabs at a piano key, "and this." The maestro makes a horrible honking sound through his nose, supposedly in imitation of Kathleen. Kathleen floods crimson. The maestro instructs her coolly, "Lesson one, the scale." Lesson one. Kathleen takes a breath and steadies herself for the giant step backward. She pictures a shining sword sharp at both edges and sings the scale, pondering all the while who is worse, Sister Saint Monica or this singing teacher whom she has come to think of as the Kaiser. And before she is halfway through the scale, she decides. The accompanist is worse. Rose plays the scale and watches the singer. Decides she is not white, not even red, but green, faintly visible, called up by outrage. There are veins at her wrists, neck, temple. This is the only physical detail that corroborates the voice, which Rose knows to be not of human origin. The green must be seaweed. Rose allows her mind to wander in this way whenever she is required to play in harness. It helps take the sting from the bit. Rose has no need of fancy when she plays her own music, because there is no difference between her own music and her mind. All alone after hours in a second-story church in Harlem, far north of this studio. Free rein. But for now, lesson one, La Scala. Kathleen glowers at the accompanist. Rose blinks at the singer and allows the slightest bit of curiosity to mingle with scorn. It's 1918. New York City is inching toward the center of the universe. Its streets throng with working girls and doughboys and the gumption of immigrants from the four corners of the earth. Kathleen is sorely tempted to cut her classes, her hair, and her hems. She has forgotten all about the fashionable New York of Harper's Bazaar. She is consumed by the new New York, which is more various and fabulous at 2 in the afternoon on Mulberry Street than come midnight at the Ziegfeld Follies. In Manhattan's North End, Rose plays her own music, while outside her church window, Harlem is turning into Harlem. Rose's mother has raised her to be an example to the race, and every day the list of places Rose must never set foot in grows longer. But Kathleen is subject to no such restrictions. Her father is far away, and Giles asks no questions except to inquire, "How are you enjoying New York, dear?" First, Kathleen fell in love with New York. Then she fell in love with a New Yorker. It happened very quickly, the way things are supposed to happen when you move from New Waterford to New York at 18. The Children's Hour. At home, James slows down a bit. With Kathleen gone, it's safe for him to spend an after-supper hour in the wing-back chair again. In the corner of the front room sit 2 unopened crates of books. But there are still so many unread in the glass cabinet that James leaves the crates untouched. There will be time enough later, when Kathleen is launched in her career and he doesn't have to work so hard. 52 books, not counting the Encyclopedia Britannica. One day, I'll sit down with all my books around me and just start reading. Right now, however, there's still too much work to do. What's more, James has taken to devoting his precious evening hours to his 2 little girls, whom he has noticed for the first time. He is pleased to find they're bright, the both of them, and he reproves himself for having simply handed them over to Materia until now. He intends to make it up to them. To this end, one evening, soon after Kathleen's departure, James calls the 2 wee ones over to the wing-back chair, tucks them in on either side, opens a big book, and reads, "In the 2nd century of the Christian era, the Empire of Rome comprehended the farthest part of the earth and the most civilized portion of mankind." And the little girls listen, bewildered by the strange names and long words, but enchanted by Daddy's careful voice, by glimpses of wonderful worlds that unfold at his command, and most of all, by his special attention. It is different from the thrill they experienced with Kathleen. With Daddy, they are aware of something rare and solemn. They understand that he is teaching them, and they respond with as much reverence as they can muster. Mercedes is almost 6. She never fails to bring Daddy his tea, balancing it carefully along with the evening's book. She is a good child, who takes her role as Mama's helper and Francis's big sister very seriously. Although it looks likely she'll turn out on the plain side, her hair a bit mousy. Nonetheless, she has nice brown eyes and a good disposition. But James can't help being particularly taken with Francis. She is a live one, going on 5 with her burnished gold ringlets and mischievous grin, green lights dancing in her hazel eyes, always ready with a joke for Daddy.
"I've got your nose."
And full of good ideas for games that she and Mercedes can play.
"Mercedes, let's shave. Mercedes, know what? These buttons can fit in our noses."
Mercedes has learned by trial and error when to say okay and when to say, "Let's pretend." James doesn't like the sound of Materia and the children chattering in Arabic, but he doesn't object. He simply counters with the special time they spend together after supper. He leavens the weight of classics with fairy tales and rhymes. The girls love poems and learn them easily. Standing at the foot of his chair, holding hands, neat as 2 pins in Kathleen's old frocks, blue for Mercedes, red for Francis, their button boots so nicely shined, they recite in piping sing-song voices,
I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He is very, very like me from the heels up to the head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed.
Then Francis squeals with glee, and Mercedes curtsies. James smiles and claps. Francis scrambles onto his knee, Mercedes lays her cheek against his hand, and James feels the ice in his chest breaking up. The war is finally over. He is home again, and everything is turning out all right after all. I have you fast in my fortress, and will not let you depart, but put you down into the dungeon in the round tower of my heart. And there I will keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, till the walls shall crumble to ruin and moulder in dust away. There are fewer letters from Kathleen than James would like, but now and then Giles sends a card assuring him that all is well. In June, a package arrives from Kathleen containing twin sailor boy dolls, one for Francis and one for Mercedes. They are thrilled and immediately take the new additions to meet the rest of their doll family. Look, children, these are your new American cousins. There is also a letter, and James calls his girls to the wing-back chair and reads it aloud.
Dear Daddy and Mama and young ladies, I am making wonderful progress under the expert tutelage of my voice teacher. He could not be better pleased, and neither could I. Giles is a wonderful companion, and she has introduced me to a number of quite inspiring cultural experiences. To date, I have enjoyed excursions to the Museum of Natural History, as well as theatrical evenings of modern dance. There is also a good deal of modern music being premiered in Manhattan, and it is a privilege to be among the first to hear such groundbreaking compositions. There are also numerous soldiers passing through on their way to the front. And I plan to assist Giles in wrapping bandages, although I cannot claim any great skill with knitting needles, and would pity the poor soldier who received a pair of socks from me. These diversions aside, my time is almost entirely caught up with lessons and practice, practice, practice. Please say hello to Sister St. Cecilia if you happen to see her in town. I will write again soon. Love, Kathleen. Content, James folds the letter and tucks it into his breast pocket. Then he tells Francis and Mercedes once again about how, when Kathleen finishes her schooling, they will take the train to New York City and hear her sing at the Metropolitan Opera House. Mercedes pictures a white palace, and Kathleen sitting on a throne next to a handsome prince. Francis sees a castle with mermaids swimming in a moat full of ginger beer, and Kathleen holding a sword, singing on a balcony. The summer flies past. Materia cooks, James works, the little girls thrive. By fall they can read. It has happened by osmosis, the way it ought to. After they have spent several months on Daddy's lap, following his spoken words with their eyes and pretending to read, there comes a day when they no longer have to pretend. The glass of the mirror has simply melted away, and now they are free to enter as many worlds as they like, together or alone. Thank you, Daddy. On November 7th, James walks to the post office with his girls to find a letter from New York waiting for him. There is his usual pleasure at the sight of the postmark, but it is followed today by slight surprise, for there is no return address, and his own name and address are written in a ladylike but unknown hand. While Francis and Mercedes scrupulously divide a shoestring of licorice, James opens the letter and reads. Its contents are a cruel contrast to its refined penmanship. It is signed an anonymous well-wisher. James folds the letter over and over until it is minute, and considers. Either it is a malicious joke, or it is true. He leaves that night. 3.5 days later,
At 6:05 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, he walks out of Grand Central Station. He finds Kathleen and takes her home again. Book 2. No Man's Land. O Holy Night. On the first night of summer 1919, in the attic of the house on Water Street, as Kathleen lies dying and unable to appreciate that fact due to the heaving and excessive pain, due to the blood that's all a result of the bomb jammed in the antechamber of her belly, threatening to explode before it can be dropped to earth, she has a moment's respite. A calm descends and the pain dissolves and disappears, along with the siren wail of her mother's incessant prayer warning of an air raid. God is coming, wailing in supplication, "Come, O Lord," begging God to pass over and to bless, not touch this house. O Lord, hear our prayer. O Lord, be with us at a safe distance now and at the hour of our death. This is a breech birth. The child is stuck feet first. Someone will not get out of this room alive. There was a choice to be made. It has been made. Or at least the choice has been allowed to occur. Everything disappears from sound for Kathleen. Her mother's voice, by now perhaps speaking in tongues, or at least the mother tongue, the pounding of her father's fists on the door. He'll break it down in a moment. She levitates in a profound and complete relief. Peace. Floating absence of pain. It's all over for her now. Anyone can see that. Materia sees it. Has been expecting it. Accepts it. Unlike James on the other side of the door. She gently closes her daughter's eyes, then takes a pair of scissors, the old kitchen scissors, freshly sharp and sterilized to cut the cord, and plunges the pointier blade into Kathleen's abdomen just above the topography of buried head. She makes a horizontal incision and reaches in. There's not much time. The infant will suffocate in a moment. In a moment, James will be through the door. One cut is not enough. Materia sculpts panic into a slow march, reining it in. Now, and at the hour of our... She makes another cut, a vertical one bisecting the first. She prayer dives both hands through the center of the cross-cut into the warm swamp slippery with life, past mysterious ferns and swaying fibers, searching for a handhold on sunken treasure. There an ankle, there an arm, the living treasure caught in a net of fingers. With a series of precise and dire yanks, the catch is dragged from where it lay lodged halfway down the canal, that locked, despite the battering of the seismic tides that were set off by those first gravitational yearnings. The bundle of tiny limbs and vestigial gills and unique fingerprints is hauled toward the torn surface of its small swollen sea. Its four eyes are scorched by the sudden light that jags in through the flapping entrance to the outside world. And in an instant, it is borne up and through the wound in Kathleen's belly. The air splashes and spumes against it, threatening to drown it. Them. For there are two, but they have yet to be cut in half. They are still one creature, really. Male and female segments joined at the belly by a common root system. It, they, is a blood breather and could drown in this fatal spray of oxygen. Will drown if they remain silent much longer, will become bright blue fishes in a moment. But the cords are cut, snip-snap, and tied just in time, and in an instant the shocking air is gulped and strafed into lungs. They become babies just in time, slick, bloody, new, wailing, squinting, furious, too. One of them, the male child, bleeds a little from a cut on his ankle. His feet were nestled next to his sister's head when the scissors descended. He was all set to arrive head first like a good mammal. Technically, therefore, the female twin is responsible for the death of the mother, for it is she who was Breach. But this was pure roulette. The pair had been revolving counterclockwise in the chamber for weeks before their birth was triggered. Kathleen is an abandoned mine, a bootleg mine, plundered, flooded, a ruined and dangerous shaft, stripped of fuel, of coal, of fossil ferns and sea anemones and bones, of creatures half plant, half animal, and any chance that any of it might end up a diamond. James has supposedly seen worse. He was in the war, after all. Now he finally sees something from which he will not recover. Beyond shell shock. Beyond no man's land. In a cavern in a canyon, excavating for a mine, dwelt a miner, 49er, and his daughter Clementine. Light she was, and like a fairy, and her shoes were number 9. Herring boxes, without topses, shoes they were for Clementine. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling Clementine, you are lost and gone forever. Dreadful sorry, Clementine. Here's what Kathleen saw just before the moment of respite. Between agony and release, she saw, framed by the door which is thumping like a heart attack, Pete, with his head off. Hello, little girl. This time he's not behind her in the mirror. He is out in the open. It is safe for him now. And after all, he just wants to get a look at her. Just one good look. Hello there. His no face tucked beneath his arm. Hello. And when he has looked his fill, he politely nods his stump of neck and leaves. She whimpers briefly. There is the blissful release from pain. Nothing has ever been better than this moment. It is enough. And then all we can do is see her through her mother's eyes, because her own are extinguished. Materia's dilemma was this. Do I let the mother live by removing the infant's limb by limb, finally crushing the heads to allow for complete expulsion from the mother's body? It is hard to imagine a worse sin for a Catholic. The sin resides not in the gory details of the operation, because the details of doing the right thing are equally gory. The sin resides in preferring the life of the mother to those of the children. For this you are eternally damned. Materia does the right thing by allowing the mother to die and the children to live. So why does Materia die a few days later of a guilty conscience? Because she did the right thing for the wrong reason. For a reason which was itself a mortal sin. For 2 days she wrestles with her conscience. But God is everywhere. It takes Materia 48 hours to face what she did. Although correct in the eyes of the church, was murder in his all-seeing eyes. The real reason I let my daughter die is because I knew she was better off that way. I didn't know her well, but I knew she didn't want to live any more. She preferred to die, and I allowed her to do so. Looked at from this angle, Materia has not saved 2 babies. She has mercy killed 1 young woman. And therein lies the mortal sin. For Materia cannot swear that had her daughter been clamoring for life, she might not have used the scissors to dismember the infants, rather than open the sky for them. In her heart of hearts, she suspects this might have been so. And in this suspicion, Materia discovers the chill comfort that, in the end, she managed to love her daughter after all. God sees an opening and rushes in. He makes himself comfortable in the back of Materia's mind for a couple of days, during which time she cleans obsessively. On the 3rd day, she cleans the oven, first turning on the gas to soften up the grid inside, It'll only take a moment. She is so tired. She hasn't slept in 3 nights. Not so much as a tiny ziz, and she has never worked harder. She kneels in front of the oven, peering in, waiting for the gas to do its work, her arms folded on the rack. It'll only take a moment. She rests her head upon her arms. She is so tired. She will start scrubbing in just a moment. Just one more moment. For the umpteenth time that week, James has to improvise a criminal mind, for he doesn't naturally have one. He turns off the gas, hauls his late wife upstairs and onto their bed, scrunches her rosary into her hands, then calls the doctor and the priest. This allows Materia to be buried next to Kathleen in the churchyard, instead of in an unsanctified field somewhere, in the type of place where soldiers and suicides and unbaptized babies sit out eternity, some unholy no man's land. The Mass Card. Frances is going on 6 now. She has a number of questions regarding the Mass Card, but this is clearly not the time or place to raise them. Mercedes kneels next to her, crying and crying into her little white gloves, her hanky already drenched. Daddy's face is frozen. If the wind changes, it will stay that way forever. Mrs. Lvovitz, in a pew across the aisle, is crying behind her black veil. This is the first time Mrs. Lvovitz has ever been inside a church. Mrs. McIsaac is there, too, with dusty grapes on her hat. Frances decides the wind must have changed for her long ago. Filling in for Materia at the organ is Sister St. Cecilia. Or at least it must be she, within the flowing black robe beneath the Gothic skyline of starched white wimple. Frances thinks it logical that nuns wear cathedrals on their heads. At the back of the church there is a phalanx of strangers, people with black curly hair, full features and smooth olive faces. These are some of Frances's unknown relatives. Frances's unknown grandfather Mahmoud is not present. For him, this funeral is redundant. Right now, he's locked in the back of his store, hunched on a plain wooden chair, apparently poring over a ledger. Mr. Benny the Butcher Lvovitz, Daddy and Mr. McIsaac are the pallbearers. It's all very much like Kathleen's funeral a few days ago, except for 3 things. Mama was sitting at the church organ that day instead of lying in the box. And the scary old man who peered into Kathleen's casket and muttered bad words in Mama's language, he's not here. But most important, Frances has noticed at the very back, standing next to the dark little round woman with the gray bun, one tall, lean figure. The dark lady who came with an envelope for Daddy and a candy for Frances a whole year and a bit ago. Teresa is here for some reason. Teresa the maid. Queen Teresa. Frances doesn't listen when told to keep her eyes front, and has to be yanked around by Daddy, who will reserve proper punishment for home later on. If she hurries, perhaps Frances will be able to make it out of the church in time to run after the lady and hop into the taxi with her, never to return. They will drive off together into the land of black-and-white licorice peppermint rock candy.
Eyes front!
Frances is really going to get it after the funeral. She dares not sneak another look behind her at the woman of her dreams. So she concentrates on the Mass Card instead. Saint Ambrose. The name detaches itself from the card, leaving its holy prefix behind like a tail, and floats up into her mind, where it wafts about gently until it settles via some mysterious associative route upon the infant boy who died a few nights ago in her arms. Ambrose. Yes. That will be his name. Ambrose. There have been 3 deaths in the space of 1 week at 191 Water Street, and 2 funerals, and 3 baptisms, and 3 burials, and 2 mass cards, identical, fill in the blanks. What a week. Enough to make you feel as though you've breathed laughing gas. And right now, Frances wants very badly to laugh. She can't tell why, except that it's the single worst thing a person could do right about now. Oh, no. Now that she has thought of laughing, she can't unthink it. She covers her face with her hands and grins. She tries to grin out the laughter, to exhale it silently, smoothly. But she starts to convulse and shake. She clamps her hands tighter against her face and gives in. She can no longer resist. It's like the tide of pee when you're outside playing and refuse to go inside and use the toilet. Your water breaks, and it's both a blessed relief and the ultimate mortification. Frances is spared the pee. But what could be worse than this outrageous hilarity at her mother's funeral, which comes 2 days after her sister's funeral, which came 2 days after all the baptisms and the death of... Oh, no! Tears of laughter are darkening her white cotton gloves. Frances expects her father's hand to grip the back of her neck, expects to be dragged in disgrace from the church. But what happens instead is a gentle pat upon her head, her father's sympathetic hand, her sister's offer of a sodden hanky. Frances is amazed. They think I'm crying. Frances learns something in this moment that will allow her to survive and function for the rest of her life. She finds out that one thing can look like another, that the facts of a situation don't necessarily indicate anything about the truth of a situation. In this moment, fact and truth become separated and commence to wander like twins in a fairy tale, waiting to be reunited by that special someone who possesses the secret of telling them apart. Some would say that Frances learned how to lie. Of all her secrets, Ambrose was Frances's biggest. He was also her greatest gift to Lily. Cave paintings. When the attic door finally gave way, James saw this silent portrait, Death and the Young Mother. It's an overdone, tasteless, melodramatic painting. A folk painting from a hot culture. Naive, grotesque, authentic. This is not a gauzy Victorian death scene, no fetishized feminine pallor, no agnostic slant of celestial light, no decorously distraught husband. This portrait is in livid color. A crucified Christ hangs over a metal frame single bed. On either side of the crucifix are 2 small pictures. One is of the Virgin Mary exposing her sacred heart aflame. The other is of her son Jesus, his heart likewise exposed and pierced to precious blood by a chain of thorns. They look utterly complacent, mother and son. They have achieved a mutual plateau of exquisite suffering. On the bed lies the young mother. Her eyes are closed. Her blonde red hair is damp and ratty on the pillow. The sheets are black with blood. The center of her body is ravaged. A plump, dark woman who looks much older than 33 stands over her. This is the grandmother. She holds 2 dripping infants trussed by the ankles, 1 in each hand, like a canny shopper guesstimating the weight of a brace of chickens. The grandmother's face looks straight out from the picture at the viewer. If this were really a painting, there would also be a demon peering out from under the lid of the hope chest at the foot of the bed, looking to steal the young mother's soul. But he'd be preempted by her guardian angel waiting in the wings to guide her already departing soul up to God. The soul, half in, half out of the tomb of her body, is in very good condition. The hair freshly combed, the nightgown spotless, the face expressionless. The first divine divestiture has taken place. She has sloughed off her personality like an old skin. She won't need it where she's going. Above the crucifix, the wall has dematerialized. Clouds hover. Somewhere within is God, waiting. But since this is not really a painting, but a moment freeze-framed by James's eye, the supernatural elements are, if present, invisible. There is the dead young mother, the grandmother, the infants, the icons, the hope chest. What can you do with such a picture? You never want to see it again, yet you can't bring yourself to burn it or slash it to dust. You have to keep it. Put it in the hope chest, James. Yes, that's a good place for it. No one ever rummages in there. This is crazy, of course. You can't stuff a memory of a moment into a real-life hope chest as if it were a family heirloom. But for a second, James feels as though that's what he's looking at. An old portrait that he hid in the hope chest many years ago and just stumbled upon again. This temporary confusion is a premonition. It tells him that he will never get over this sight. That it will be as fresh 14 years from now, the colors not quite dry, just as it is today. James goes out of the room, but not far. His legs give way, and he collapses outside the fallen door, unconscious. He doesn't hear the first cries of the babies inside. The involuntary part of his mind does, though. It is just not conveying the message. It is keeping it on a crumpled piece of paper on the floor of its cave. It is taking a break, admiring its cave painting by the light of the dark. A few moments later, James's hand shoots out and fastens on Materia's ankle, almost toppling her down the narrow staircase as she leaves the room. James's mouth opens a split second before his eyes.
Where the hell are you going?
I'm gonna get the priest.
No, you're not.
He's awake now.
They gonna be baptized.
No, they're not.
They gotta be baptized.
No!
James roars.
You're gonna kill them. You're gonna kill their souls. You're the devil.
She's hitting him, closed fists in his face. If the scissors were handy, she wouldn't bother to shut his eyes first.
Ibn Sharmutka, kes imak, ya kereb beitak, ya haradinak.
If the bayonet were near, she would not hesitate, and God would understand. Why didn't she think of this before? Materia, too, is awake now, after a 19-year slumber. She will kill him if she can. James gets her wrists in a vice grip. His other hand clamps across her mouth. Her eyes roll back. James tells her, "Who's the killer, eh? Who's the killer? God damn you! God damn you! Damn you!" He begins to punctuate the curses by slowly slamming her head into the wall. Her eyes are trying to reason with him, but without the help of words, her eyes become a horse's eyes, as mute, as panicked. Her tears are flowing now, his lips tripping on salt and snot, his nose bleeding. He's retching out the most agonizing man sobs. The wall is starting to conform to her skull. This time, however, he hears the tiny cries from inside, like kittens. He picks up Materia and carries her 3 flights down to the coal cellar and locks her in. Then he goes for a walk, and many fast drinks, of course.